Repentance presupposes that we are free and morally responsible agents who are capable of change, specifically the change that comes about when we recognize that something we have done is wrong, and we are responsible for it, and we must never do it again. The possibility of that kind of moral transformation simply did not exist in ancient Greece or any other pagan culture. Welcome to Parsha and Politics, Parashat Ki Tisa, Wabi Sabi and the Second Tablets. I'm Meir Soloveitchik.
Welcome to Parsha and Politics, How Torah Changed the World. This series is brought to you by MeirSoloveitchik.com, a project of Tikva. If you'd like to learn more with Rabbi Soloveitchik, we invite you to subscribe at MeirSoloveitchik.com. This week's episode is generously sponsored by Galit Tamar Luria.
Let us ponder the Japanese notion of wabi-sabi, a phrase that combines two very different words, each difficult to translate. Yet combined, they connote a joy in the uniqueness and beauty of the imperfect object, in the recognition that such an object reflects its human creator, and therefore the nature of human existence. The concept is described in a book by Nobuo Suzuki titled Wabi Sabi, The Wisdom of Imperfection. He writes, quote, "One of the distinguishing features of Japanese culture is its peculiar concept of beauty. For a Westerner, even for a Chinese, the most beautiful cup is an impeccably fashioned one, with a perfect circumference, a smooth, immaculate surface, and, if it is decorated, an exact and uniform arrangement of the decorations. In Japan, however, the most highly prized cup and the most expensive tends to be the one that contains flaws, because that makes it unique. It may have dents, sandstone stuck to it, or even be cracked or mended." End quote. For Suzuki, as he goes on to describe, and like many others that write on this subject, the notion of wabi-sabi bears with it lessons for life. He adds, quote, "Apply to humans, being aware of our imperfections makes us humble. Accepting it frees us from being unhealthily self-demanding and from the fixation on a perfection that does not exist in nature and by extension does not exist in humans either. Accepting our own imperfection and each person's unique nature does not mean resignation. On the contrary, it shows us the path to follow to evolve as human beings." End quote. As Suzuki and others further describe, one exquisite embodiment of wabi-sabi is the form of Japanese artistry known as kintsugi, in which shattered pieces of pottery are pieced together using lacquer of gold, with the gold itself reflecting where vessels had once been broken. Thus, the shattering is still remembered. It is not effaced, but marked in a way that highlights the uniqueness of the object. The artist Matsuo Fujimara, in his book Art and Faith, A Theology of Making, gives us stories of the origin of kintsugi, including a tale of the great expert in tea-making, Yusai Hosokawa. He writes, quote, "When he was to prepare tea for the warlord Hideyoshi, Hideyoshi's young attendant dropped an invaluable piece of teaware, one of Hideyoshi's favorites, breaking it into five pieces. Hideyoshi raised his hand to punish the servant, but Hosokawa intervened, singing a poem that echoed a 9th-century waka. The improvised version used a romance poem between two childhood friends courting each other as adults, but a turn of phrase transformed the romance into a sacrificial mercy toward the young servant. Hosokawa, by singing this poem, basically atoned for the young servant and took responsibility, saying, 'I will be the one blamed for his mistake.' Artfully done, this clever turn of phrase spared the servant. Later, Hosokawa arranged for the five pieces of pottery to be reconnected using the Urushi Japan lacquer technique, with gold gilding, and presented it to Hideyoshi. The warlord was moved by the beauty of kintsugi teaware, and the story became renowned. This act of compassion became the basis of kintsugi, which added gold in the urushi-filled cracks, creating a work of beauty through brokenness." End quote. Thus, kintsugi became a symbol in itself of wabi-sabi, as well as a metaphor for forgiveness and moral improvement. It is therefore striking to consider our own parasha from the perspective reflected in the notion of wabi-sabi. For our reading describes a shattering that occurs. The tablets given by God, shattered by Moses at the foot of Sinai in the wake of the sin of the golden calf. Yet as our parasha further describes, another set of tablets are made, and unlike the first, which were forged entirely by the fiery finger of God, the second set is carved by Moses with the letters of the Ten Commandments then inscribed by the Almighty. According to Jewish tradition, this second set of tablets, symbol of God's forgiveness, was bestowed on Yom Kippur. And for the great early medieval sage Sadia Gaon, there is therefore a sense in which this set created by Moses was greater than that fashioned by God himself. Sadia is cited by Abraham Ibn Ezra, who writes, The Gaon said that the second are more honored than the first, for the second were given on a sacred day and on the Day of Atonement, unlike the first. So Ibn Ezra writes, but he notes in turn that he finds Sadia's position preposterous. How can an object created by man be greater than the creation of God? As Ibn Ezra bitingly remarks, quote, "These are like the words of a dream. They are neither helpful nor a hindrance, for the writing of God was on both. And moreover, the first were an act of God and the second merely of Moses." So Ibn Ezra reflects, how, he is asking, how can the imperfect result of human effort be greater than the act of God? Perhaps, strangely, Japanese art allows us to answer this question. As our reading begins, the stage is being set for the glorious conclusion to the Sinai revelation. Moses, on Sinai, has already received the blueprints for the tabernacle, through which the divine will dwell in Israel, as well as the designs of the clothing for the priests that minister therein. In our reading, he is instructed as to how every Israelite shall be counted and fund the tabernacle through the giving of the half shekel, a symbol of the joining of every single member of society to Israel's endeavors. Moses is further told of Bezalel, the artistically ingenious individual who is to oversee the tabernacle's construction. All is set for God's home to be created in Israel. And Moses, before descending Sinai, is given the gift that will be placed in the tabernacle's Holy of Holies, the tablets created by God. But then all goes awry. As Moses remains in the mists of the mountain, Israel grows nervous, then desperate. A golden calf is created and served. The Almighty, enraged at this sin, informs Moses that he will now destroy Israel and create a new nation from Moses alone. But Moses refuses the Almighty's offer and beseeches the Almighty to forgive. It was familial love of Israel that drew Moses to his mission in Egypt, when giving up on that love to found a new people all his own was unthinkable. On Sinai, at the burning bush, God had introduced himself as the God of Moses' father. Now, again on Sinai, Moses speaks to God of the forefathers, saying, "Zechor la'Avraham li'Yitzchak u'li'Yaakov, remember Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, your servants, to whom you swore by your name." God relents and agrees that Israel will live. As Moses descends the mountain and witnesses Israel in the midst of sin, he too appears overcome by anger and shatters the tablets, the symbol of the covenant, at the foot of the mountain. This is, of course, also a metaphor. The relationship between God and Israel has been shattered, at this point seemingly irreparably so. God announces that he will not dwell among his people. An angel of the Almighty will instead guide Israel in its journey, a sign that Israel will not be truly forgiven. At this point, it seems that all of the instruction regarding the tabernacle has been in vain. Yet Moses refuses to relent, insisting that his own role in history is bound up in God's granting of forgiveness, saying, "V'ata im tisa chatatam, v'im ayin mecheni na misifracha asher katavta." Now if you will forgive their sin, meaning, then good. But if not, erase me from the record which you have written. Paradoxically, in saying this to God, Moses reveals why God chose him. The same man who risked himself for his brothers when threatened by the Egyptians is also willing to sacrifice for them when they are threatened by God himself.
I hope you're enjoying this exploration of the Parsha's political wisdom. You can continue learning with Rabbi Soloveitchik at meirsoloveitchik.com, where you'll find a growing Torah library of online video courses, essays, and his two daily podcasts, Bible 365, a year-long study of the entire Tanakh, and Jerusalem 365, which explores the 4,000-year history of the Jewish people's eternal capital in a single year.
God relents and forgives, making known for the first time that he, God, is not only, as he declaimed at Sinai, a jealous God that reacts angrily to idolatry. He is also a Kelchanun Verachum, a God of grace and mercy. A second set of tablets are to be created as a symbol of the forgiveness bestowed. Here we must take note of the way in which, as our series title puts it, Torah changed the world. For in the giving of the second set of tablets, we discover what is perhaps as important a message as that which Judaism gave to humanity in the Decalogue. We discover here the invention of repentance and forgiveness. Rabbi Sachs has explained how this is so. Quote, "The sociologist Philip Reif pointed out that the movement from paganism to monotheism was a transition from fate to faith. By this he meant that in the world of myth, people were pitted against powerful, capricious forces personified as gods who were at best indifferent, at worst hostile to humankind. All you could do was try to propitiate, battle, or outwit them. This was a culture of character and fate, and its noblest expression was the literature of Greek tragedy." End quote. In other words, the pagan world believed in shame and sin without the true possibility of repentance, forgiveness, redemption. The Bible, however, approaches human development differently. Rabbi Sachs further writes, quote, "Repentance presupposes that we are free and morally responsible agents who are capable of change, specifically the change that comes about when we recognize that something we have done is wrong, and we are responsible for it, and we must never do it again. The possibility of that kind of moral transformation simply did not exist in ancient Greece or any other pagan culture. This transformed the human situation. For the first time, it established the possibility that we are not condemned endlessly to repeat the past. End quote. Biblical Israel did not only change the world in creating its covenant, but also in the recreation of the covenant, when the second set of tablets appeared on the earth. The recreation, after a shattering, embodied the grandeur of human capacity in the midst of humanity's own fallibility and imperfection. It is with this in mind that we can understand why God insisted that this time the tablets would be created not only by God, but also by man. Thus the beginning of chapter 34. And the Lord said to Moses, "Carve for yourself two tablets of stone, akin to the first, and I will write on the tablets the statements that were on the first tablets that you shattered." The tablets would be made by man and would therefore be imperfect, and they would therefore embody human life itself. Strikingly, in the depiction of this moment given us by the Victorian artist John Rogers Herbert, with Moses granting another set of tablets to a grateful Israel, we can notice how roughly hewn and imperfect the tablets actually are, a sign of the human being that brought them into existence. In their very imperfection, these tablets embody us. As symbols of the possibility of improvement, the very flaws of the humanly created tablets embody hope itself. The tablets, in other words, are who we can be. They teach the world how to see our own moral capacity. Their imperfection are therefore the source of their grandeur. If there is a portrait of a human being that captures the spirit of the second tablets, it is Rembrandt's strange and striking self-portrait with two circles. Two aspects of the painting stand out that seem somewhat strange. The first is that Rembrandt has left his own hand, the hand of an artist, missing from the canvas. The second is the geometric addition to the canvas of two circles that seem to have nothing to do with the image itself. In truth, these two oddities are connected, and here, in offering an explanation of the painting, I am very much drawing on an interpretation by Simon Schama. Rembrandt deliberately highlights his own imperfections as an artist by leaving his hand unfinished. And yet, lest anyone assume that this unfinished aspect was due to his losing his ability to draw and paint in old age, Rembrandt goes out of his way to highlight how he can still draw brilliantly. To create a circle, Schama noted, is incredibly hard, and therefore Rembrandt shows of what he is still absolutely capable. When we combine these two themes and take them together in tandem, we realize that Rembrandt is seeking to highlight both his gifts and his flaws, seeing in this dialectic not a discouragement, but a drive for further invention and even greatness. The imperfect tablets remind us of the shattering that came before, but also of the potential for repair. In this way, they are not unlike the Japanese embodiment of wabi-sabi, reflected in pieces of pottery rejoined after a shattering, with the breaks remembered, marked by gold. The remembrance of the shattering is a reminder of the overcoming of the shattering, an overcoming which has a beauty all its own. As one writer, Tiffany Ayuda, put it in Kintsugi, quote, "Every break is unique, and instead of repairing an item like new, the 400-year-old technique actually highlights the scars as part of the design. Using this as a metaphor for healing ourselves teaches us an important lesson. Sometimes in the process of repairing things that have broken, we actually create something more unique, beautiful, and resilient." End quote. We are therefore able to understand Sadia's suggestion that the second tablets have a beauty and grandeur all their own that the first perfect tablets did not have, for they pointed to the resiliency of the human being that is made manifest in the very imperfections of life, to hope after a shattering. Understood this way, the story of the tablets carved by Moses teaches us not only about repentance, but also about the ability of a people to overcome many different forms of shatterings that have occurred throughout its history. Is not Kintsugi the story of the Jews? Has our people not overcome so many shatterings, pieced itself together, and endured? And is that overcoming not part of the grandeur of the Jewish story? The Japanese celebration of imperfect art is profoundly related to Jewish history. In a wonderful essay, Sarah Ridner reflects on artistic creations that are unfinished, such as the Rembrandt portrait with the missing hand. And though she does not make mention of wabi-sabi, she does describe how shatterings and imperfect art hint to a theme related to the resilience of the Jewish people. Quote, "An echo of the unfinished aesthetic may be identified in the Jewish practices surrounding mourning. Upon hearing of a loss, a Jewish mourner traditionally rips his or her garment, and Jewish tradition is replete with rituals that remind us of the incomplete nature of our happiness in the wake of the destruction of the Holy Temple in Jerusalem, which occurred in 70 AD. For example," Ridner continues, "if a Jewish family builds a new home, they are required to leave a visible patch of it unplastered. In a sense, the home remains unfinished as a reminder that God's home has yet to be rebuilt. Reflecting upon a patch of unpainted canvas in the otherwise complete Street in Avesrouille by Vincent van Gogh at the Met Breuer, I was reminded of this uniquely Jewish practice known as a Zecher Lechurban, a reminder of the destruction. There are," Ridner continues, "a variety of customs that are associated with Zecher Lechurban, some of them more widely observed than others. For example, a glass is shattered under a Jewish wedding canopy. Women are instructed not to wear all of their fine jewelry at any one time, and in some circles, even listening to music is curtailed. The pervasiveness of these customs does not reflect a sense of nihilism or a cult of mourning. Rather, the sages say that whoever mourns over Jerusalem will merit to see in its joy. Counterintuitively, reminding ourselves of our incompleteness specifically points to the promise of an eventual restoration. End quote. We reflect on the shattering of the tablets at a time when, not long ago, a shattering occurred to the Jewish people. But we have also seen, in the weeks that followed, a covenantal kintsugi, a coming together, and a reflection of resilience in which the very scars are the source and sign of the bonds Jews share. As we read this week of the tablets recreated, we hope and pray for many more restorations yet to come. This is Meir Soloveitchik, wishing you a Shabbat Shalom, looking forward to learning together next week, signing off.